Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive, where we turn your stack of sources into immediate, actionable insight.
Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into an institution whose influence stretches from, well, the Revolutionary War trenches, all the way to the modern halls of corporate power.
We are talking about the United States Military Academy. You know it simply as West Point.
And we're going to unpack why this place, which you might just see as a high-discipline military training ground, is actually, it's an enduring 223-year-old educational model that profoundly shaped the physical landscape, the political DNA, and even the very structure of American higher education.
It's so much more than just soldiers.
Oh, absolutely. It's a story about engineers, educators, and leaders.
And that's the mission for you, the listener, today. We want to move beyond that popular image of, you know, marching parades and rigid honor codes.
Right.
We want to provide a quick but really comprehensive understanding of West Point's history, its unique curriculum, what they call the four pillars, and the massive enduring influence of the Long Gray Line.
And let's ground ourselves, literally, because the physical location it's the foundation of everything. West Point is situated on this incredible strategic high ground, overlooking a critical bend in the Hudson River. It's about 50 miles north of New York City.
And that geography is the whole reason the academy exists at all, isn't it?
It is the only reason.
The facts are just. They're impressive. It was officially established by the Military Peace Establishment Act on March 16, 1802. That makes it the oldest of the five American service academies.
And its motto is, well, it's three simple, powerful words.
Duty, honor, country.
Exactly. And that motto drives its entire dual identity. They are, of course, educating cadets for service as commissioned officers in the U.S. Army, yes. But they are also granting a comprehensive, fully accredited Bachelor of Science degree.
And here's the big picture nugget that, for me, immediately reframes how you should view this institution. When West Point was founded, America desperately needed infrastructure. We were, building a nation from scratch.
Right. Roads, canals, bridges, everything.
So West Point wasn't just a military school. It was the first American college to have an accredited civil engineering program.
And that fact is so key. For decades, its curriculum and its incredibly rigorous standards set the absolute benchmark for American technical education.
So if you wanted to learn civil engineering in, say, 1820,
you either went to West Point or you learned from a West Point graduate. That was pretty much it. And that massive, often overlooked civilian influence is where we need to start.
Okay, let's unpack that historical journey then. We can't understand the academy without first understanding why the Army staked its claim on that particular spot on the Hudson.
The site's military importance dates back to the very, very start of the American Revolution. The Continental Army occupied West Point on January 27th, 1778.
And that date is important. It makes it the oldest continuously operating Army post in the entire United States.
It does. And the necessity was. Yeah. It was acute. The British strategy was brutally simple. Sail the powerful Royal Navy fleet up the Hudson River, which is the main artery connecting the northern colonies, and split the entire colonial effort in two.
Just cut New England off from everyone else.
Isolate them and choke the revolution out. West Point was the perfect counter to that. The high cliffs gave American artillery total control over that S-curve in the river.
But they needed more than just cannons, right? They needed a physical barrier.
They did. To make that defense absolute, they built the great Hudson River chain. And this was an astonishing feat of engineering for the time. We're talking about a 1,700-foot-long chain weighing 65 tons.
65 tons.
Stretched across the entire river on these large wooden rafts anchored to the shore. It was the physical barrier, the literal chain, that prevented the Royal Navy from ever sailing north.
That's a staggering detail. A chain built to hold back an entire naval fleet.
Yeah.
And right here, this is where we encounter the dark side of that revolutionary history.
Indeed. The fortifications at West Point were, for a brief time, named for Arnold.
After Benedict Arnold.
Yes, before the commander, Benedict Arnold, famously attempted to hand the entire position, the absolute key to the northern colonies, over to the British in exchange for a huge financial reward and a general's commission.
The ultimate betrayal.
It was devastating. After his act of treason was exposed in 1780, the army immediately changed the name of the fortifications to Fort Clinton. They were essentially trying to erase his memory from that sacred ground.
And that attempt to sell the crown jewel of the revolution, it just underscores how vital that high ground at West Point truly was.
Exactly. And, you know, while the site was secure, the post-revolutionary vision for an officer school was, well, it was chaotic. The formal establishment in 1802 was really slow to gain traction.
What do you mean by chaotic?
I mean, we're talking about an early student body where ages range from 10 to 37. There was no standardized course of study. A cadet might study for 6 months or 6 years. It really wasn't a school. It was barely a training camp.
It sounds completely unstable. So when was the turning point? When did West Point truly become West Point?
That didn't happen until 1817 with the arrival of Colonel Sylvanus Thayer. He is, and rightly so, known as the father of the military academy.
He didn't just tweak the system, did he?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
He revolutionized it. He had traveled extensively in Europe and was deeply impressed by the French model, specifically the École Polytechnique.
Which was basically the premier scientific and engineering school in the world at the time.
The absolute best. And Thayer decided to transplant its rigor, its curriculum, and its disciplinary structure directly to the banks of the Hudson River.
So what did the Thayer Revolution mean in practice for the cadets on the ground?
It meant the abolition of that chaotic ad hoc learning. He instituted strict disciplinary standards. He set a 4-year standardized course of academic study that was incredibly heavy on math and science. And maybe most importantly, he made honorable conduct the absolute centerpiece of the entire experience.
And that is what gave birth to the engineering era.
It is. For the next 5 decades, basically the first half of the 19th century West Point graduates became the nation's primary. Well, it's construction workers. They were the bulk of the talent that engineered the nation's initial railway lines, mapped its harbors, built its bridges, and surveyed the roads for Western expansion.
It's just hard to overstate the civilian impact. I mean, until Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute was established in 1824, West Point was pretty much the only engineering school in the country.
And its influence wasn't subtle. Its curriculum, its textbooks, its whole approach to instruction significantly influenced every single American engineering school that was established before the Civil War. They literally wrote the book on how America would build itself.
But the ultimate validation of this kind of rigorous training, I mean, it had to come through conflict, right?
It had to. And the first major test was the Mexican-American War.
This is where it gets really interesting, because that conflict served as a proving ground for the Academy's graduates.
It really did. Of the 523 graduates who served, an astonishing 452 received battlefield promotions or awards for bravery. The training absolutely held up under fire.
And it's where history's biggest names really cut their teeth.
Exactly. Future Civil War commanders like Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, who actually later returned to serve as the Academy's superintendent from 1852 to 1855, they first distinguished themselves during the campaigns in Mexico.
So there was this shared experience, a shared training, a shared competence that was just unmistakable.
Yes. But that shared competency led to what has to be the most devastating irony in the Academy's history.
The Civil War divide.
It was catastrophic for the alumni body. It tore friendships and loyalties completely apart. But at the same time, it served as the strongest possible testament to West Point's successful training model.
Oh, so?
Because nearly every single general officer of note on both sides was a West Point graduate.
The statistics on that are just stunning. 294 graduates served as general officers for the Union, and 151 served as general officers for the Confederacy.
And think about the common thread here. A West Point graduate commanded forces on one or both sides in all 60 major battles of the war.
On the 60.
Every single one. That fact speaks volumes. The Civil War wasn't just a conflict between states. It was a conflict fought largely by men who were educated under the Thayer system, using the same mathematical principles for artillery, the same engineering principles for logistics and fortification. Their training determined the course of the war.
So, following that agonizing divide, the Academy faced huge internal challenges. I imagine just reintegrating cadets from former Confederate states was a nightmare.
A huge challenge. But the biggest challenge was social integration.
Right. 1870 was a key date, with the admission of the first black cadet, James Webster Smith.
Yes. And his time there was incredibly difficult. He endured just awful, harsh treatment, which, sadly, was often racially motivated. And he was ultimately dismissed for academic deficiency in 1874 under circumstances that many historians now consider really controversial.
But the progress, though painful, it did continue.
It did. Henry O. Flipper of Georgia became the first black graduate in 1877. But at the same time, the internal culture of the academy was, well, it was hardening. After the Civil War, hazing, which had been less formalized before, took on a much harsher tone.
Why was that?
Well, you saw veterans returning to the academy as officers or instructors who viewed hazing not as simple horseplay, but as a necessary disciplinary tool, a way to weed out the unfit and force immediate obedience on new cadets.
And that harsh practice eventually blew up into the national spotlight.
It did in 1900 with the death of Cadet Oscar L. Booz. That ignited congressional hearings into the academy's culture. Even a young Douglas MacArthur, who was a cadet at the time, he testified during those investigations.
And when MacArthur later came back as superintendent in 1919, he specifically tried to curb hazing, right?
He did. He assigned Army surgeons to run the freshman summer training, trying to professionalize what had become an amateur and often brutal tradition among the upperclassmen.
Okay, so before MacArthur's time as superintendent, there was another pivotal period, one that's often discussed in military history circles. The graduating classes between 1900 and 1915.
Ah, yes. Especially the class of 1915.
They are famously known as the class the stars fell on.
And for good reason. This cohort produced a simply remarkable density of leadership talent, right on the cusp of America's entry onto the world stage in World War I. 59 of the 164 graduates became general officers.
59. That's an exceptionally high percentage.
It's incredible. And this includes iconic five-star figures like Dwight D. Eisenhower and Omar Bradley. Hmm. It's almost as if fate put all those eggs in one basket right when they were needed for the global conflicts to come.
It's an amazing historical confluence. So now that we understand the historical model, the engineering foundation, the Thayer rigor, and the validation through war, let's look at how that structure endures in the modern academy.
The administrative structure is a fascinating paradox. It's built like an elite university, but it functions under a strict military chain of command.
At the top is the superintendent.
Right. A three-star general, a lieutenant general. They act as the university president or chancellor, but they report directly to the Army Chief of Staff.
So that ensures that even though it's an academic institution, its mission and accountability are directly linked to the highest levels of the U.S. Army.
Precisely. And you have two other general officers who manage the daily operations, creating this kind of military triumvirate.
You have the Commandant of Cadets.
A Brigadier General who is essentially the Dean of Students. He's responsible for all the military training, the discipline, the overall quality of life for the Corps. And then you have the Dean of the Academic Board.
Also Brigadier General, who functions as the Provost, managing the entire academic curriculum and the faculty.
And what's unique about the academic leadership is the academic board itself. It's composed of 13 tenured colonels who are the department heads. They hold the special title Professors USMA, or PSMA.
And that PSMA status is unique, isn't it?
Very. These are tenured officers. They are colonels, many with doctorates, who teach for decades. This blend ensures that the academic curriculum remains grounded in the practical long-term needs of the Army. It prevents the academic priorities from floating too far into purely theoretical research.
That rigor starts immediately with the admissions process, which is famously a two-tiered hurdle.
The first tier is just meeting the high basic requirements. Candidates have to be between 17 and 23 years old, unmarried, no legal dependents. And academically, the expectation is stellar. 68% of accepted candidates rank in the top fifth of their high school class.
And of course, they have to pass the candidate fitness assessment, a demanding physical test.
But the true gatekeeper is that second tier, the nomination. You have to apply directly to USMA and secure a nomination, usually from a member of Congress, a representative, or a senator.
And that nomination process itself is competitive even before you get to West Point's acceptance criteria.
Absolutely. It involves writing essays, getting recommendations, and going through a formal interview with the nominating official or their local board. You can also get a nomination from the vice president or the president, but those slots are extremely limited.
So it's intensely selective. For the class of 2024, the acceptance rate was 7.74%. That's comparable to many of the nation's most elite civilian universities.
And they want you for four full years, no matter what.
That's a non-negotiable point, right? West Point does not accept transfers.
Nope. If you have 2 years of college experience, you still enter as a fourth-class cadet, a plebe, and you have to complete the entire four-year program. They are buying into the holistic development of the whole person, not just racking up academic credits.
We should also touch on the preparatory school path, USMPS. That's a crucial safety valve, isn't it?
It is. If a candidate is highly desired but maybe isn't quite ready academically, perhaps they need a stronger foundation in math or science, they might get an offer to attend the U.S. Military Academy Preparatory School for a year.
So USMPS provides that specialized academic, leadership, and physical prep.
Exactly. It's a chance for a candidate to prove they can handle the academic load before being officially appointed to the academy the following year. It really expands the talent pool and helps ensure a diversity of backgrounds.
Okay, moving from the people to the place itself. When you walk onto the campus, you are walking into a living museum.
You really are. The academy area, including those original Revolutionary War fort ruins, was rightfully declared a National Historic Landmark in 1960.
And the architecture is just so distinctive.
It's defined by that massive construction project started in 1902. They chose the Neo-Gothic style, built almost entirely from locally sourced granite, which gives it that striking gray and black hue, the source of the name, the Long Gray Line.
The Cadet Chapel is the masterpiece of that style.
Oh, absolutely. Completed in 1910, it looks like a medieval cathedral that's been dedicated to duty.
And at the center of all this is the plain, the massive central parade ground. And that's where you find the monuments to West Point's heroes.
Right. The Washington Monument, the Thayer Monument, and of course monuments to those class of 1915 legends, Eisenhower and MacArthur. And there's also the General John Sedgwick Monument, which, as we'll discuss later, holds a wonderful, strange tradition.
The history continues right into the West Point Cemetery. It feels like a truly sacred space.
It is. It's the final resting place for icons like George Armstrong Custer and Winfield Scott. It's also home to 18 Medal of Honor recipients and, critically, holds the graves of recent graduates who gave their lives in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Tying the Academy's long history directly to the present.
Exactly. And to really understand the weight of that history, you have to visit the West Point Museum. It's the oldest military museum in the country.
And it's more than just Army gear. The collection tells the story of America's involvement in global conflict.
I love that collection. And instead of just listing artifacts, let's focus on two specific ones that tell a story. You have George Washington's pistols, which represent the founding of the army and the struggle for independence. And then you skip forward 150 years and you find Adolf Hitler's gold-plated Lilliput pistol and Hermann Göring's captured dagger.
Wow.
And that contrast from the revolutionary fight for freedom to the capture of the instruments of fascism, it shows that West Point acts as the institutional memory for America's moral and physical defense across two centuries.
That's a fascinating synthesis. It really emphasizes their role as curators of American military history. Now let's move to the heart of the cadet experience, those four pillars that define their education and separate it from a traditional college.
The academic education is the first pillar, and it is defined by a commitment to the Bachelor of Science degree, no matter what your chosen major is.
This means the curriculum is highly structured. Cadets have to take 31 core courses that are perfectly balanced between the arts and the sciences.
That balance is completely non-negotiable. You have 45 majors available, everything from foreign languages and history to mechanical engineering and management information systems. But that core curriculum is the great equalizer. Cadets don't even declare their majors until the spring of their freshman year.
But even after you declare, say, history, you are still taking advanced courses in calculus, physics, chemistry, constitutional law, economics, and information technology.
Exactly. It forces a technical competency onto the humanities students, and it forces a political and historical context onto the engineering students.
The goal is to produce well-rounded, analytical leaders, not narrow specialists.
That's the whole belief. A lieutenant needs to understand both the mechanics of logistics, which is engineering, and the political context of the battlefield, which is history and law.
And the method of teaching this incredibly dense curriculum is the famous Thayer method. This seems to be the core difference between West Point and a big university lecture hall.
It is. The Thayer method is simple in concept, but it's brutal in execution. It involves mandatory preparation, daily homework, and small classes, usually fewer than 18 students.
And the professor doesn't deliver a lecture.
No. The student is responsible for reading the material before class and preparing to teach or apply the concept themselves.
So you show up ready to synthesize, not just absorb. The class time is spent with the professor leading collaborative discussion, solving problems on the board, and challenging the cadets to immediately apply the concepts.
It demands constant, relentless preparedness you cannot hide in the back of the room.
And that standard is reflected in the faculty. The mix is intentional. 75% military officers, often with graduate degrees, and 25% civilian professors with PhDs.
Right. This provides practical grounding from the officers and deep scholarly continuity from the civilian staff. It's a really effective blend.
Now, all of these elements, academic performance, military leadership, physical fitness, they get combined into the overall class rank calculation.
Yes, and that rank is absolutely critical. It determines what Army branch you are allowed to enter: infantry, aviation, engineering, and so on, and where you will be assigned.
So what's the formula? How is it weighted?
It's strict. 55% academic performance, 30% military leadership performance, and 15% physical fitness and athletic performance. It is a genuine, holistic evaluation of the whole person.
So while academics are the most weighted factor, leadership and physical readiness are absolutely essential.
You can't just be a bookworm. Which brings us to the second pillar, military training and development. This is the ultimate goal, right? Commissioning every graduate as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army.
The transition from civilian applicant to cadet is notoriously abrupt. It starts on reception day, or R Day.
That's the day the entering freshmen, the new cadets, begin cadet basic training. And it's universally called Beast Barracks, or just Beast.
And for anyone listening who hasn't experienced it, this is often the most intense and difficult period of a cadet's life.
It's a relentless 7-week immersion. They are stripped of their civilian identity, taught fundamental soldier skills, subjected to intense physical training, and introduced to military discipline and the honor code. It's designed to be a crucible that welds the class together.
And that rigor continues throughout the summers. The second summer is dedicated to cadet field training, or CFT.
Right, held at Camp Buckner, focusing on more advanced field craft, marksmanship, and platoon-level operations.
And later summers offer more specialized opportunities.
They do. Cadets might be selected to serve as instructors for the younger classes, which is a huge leadership opportunity. Or they could serve with active Army units anywhere in the world, getting a real taste of the operating force.
Or they can attend some of the Army's most demanding schools.
Like airborne, to jump out of planes, air assault, to rappel from helicopters, or specialized courses like sapper for combat engineering, or pathfinder for navigation and insertion. These are critical experiences for developing junior officers.
And overseeing all of this training are active duty captains, or majors, who serve as company tactical officers, the TAC officers.
TAC officers are crucial. They are the daily mentors, the disciplinarians, the teachers of character. And they are assisted by active duty senior non-commissioned officers, the TAC and SEWs. They represent the reality of the active Army, ensuring the training is relevant and the discipline is maintained to the highest standard.
Okay, now on to the third pillar, the physical education dimension. And this is not just, you know, a gym membership. It is a mandatory core part of the curriculum.
Absolutely. The program is run by the Department of Physical Education, or DPE, and the head of DPE still holds the historic and wonderful title of the Master of the Sword.
I love that, a throwback to the days when swordsmanship was a core part of an officer's training.
It is, and every cadet must take specific, mandatory physical courses that reflect the unique demands of military service. This includes things like military movement, which is essentially applied gymnastics for navigating obstacles, boxing, survival swimming, and advanced combatives.
And beyond the courses, they have to pass the Army physical fitness test twice a year.
Just like every soldier in the force. But the defining physical challenge, the one that makes every cadet nervous, is the annual indoor obstacle course test, the IOCT.
The IOCT has been administered in Hayes Gymnasium since 1944. It is a true measure of functional military fitness, not just endurance or strength, but agility and coordination under pressure.
It's a terrifying sprint through a series of obstacles. You're navigating cargo nets, climbing ropes to the ceiling, scaling 20-foot walls, performing low crawls, and jumping over various barriers.
So it tests the ability to rapidly overcome physical challenges in sequence. And failure.
Failure means remedial training and the potential loss of privileges, or even separation from the academy. It's a huge deal.
And the importance of this pillar is emphasized by the required participation in athletics. Every single cadet, every semester, has to participate in an intercollegiate, club, or intramural sport.
And this is tied directly to General MacArthur's famous quote, "Upon the fields of friendly strife are sown the seeds that, upon other fields, on other days, will bear the fruits of victory."
The final, and arguably the most important pillar, is moral and ethical training. And this hinges entirely on the Academy's motto and its code.
The Cadet Honor Code is famous for its simple but absolute terms. A cadet will not lie, cheat, steal, or tolerate those who do.
That final clause, or tolerate those who do, That's what makes the code so demanding.
It is. It forces the cadet to choose between friendship and integrity. Ignoring an honor violation is itself a violation of the code. It creates an environment of intense self-policing.
But violating the code can lead to severe punishment, including turning back, which means you have to repeat an academic year or outright separation from the academy.
And here is what we have to exercise some critical thinking. If duty, honor, country, and the honor code are the absolute foundation, how does an institution survive two massive, high-profile cheating scandals?
That's a legitimate and very challenging question. The most dramatic example was the 1976 scandal involving 151 junior cadets, primarily in an electrical engineering course.
Right. They were all expelled, although many were later offered a chance to re-enroll after a period of service.
And it happened again in 2020, with over 70 cadets accused of cheating on remote exams during the COVID-19 pandemic.
And while the circumstances change remote learning versus in-person, the fact that systemic cheating can occur suggests that the immense pressure cooker culture might, at times, overwhelm the ethical framework.
It seems to underscore that constant tension between the desire to succeed in an intensely competitive environment and the ethical standard required for leadership.
And historically, there was an unofficial social sanction for violations known as silencing.
Tell us about that.
Silencing was this painful mechanism where cadets accused of violating the code were just completely shunned. The entire corps refused to speak to them or even acknowledge their existence. It was a form of peer social execution.
And that was eventually banned.
Yes. It was deeply divisive and came under heavy national scrutiny, which led the Academy to finally ban the practice in 1973.
These challenges really highlight that while the pillars are foundational, the pressure of maintaining that high standard is perpetual. Let's move now to how cadets actually live their lives within this demanding framework and the unique traditions that define the Corps.
The official terminology for the student body is the United States Corps of Cadets. It's organized into a military brigade led by the first captain, who's the senior ranking cadet and the commander of the entire corps.
And the classes are officially categorized as 4th, 3rd, 2nd, and 1st class.
But the colloquial nicknames are much more descriptive and fun. 4th classmen, the freshmen, are known as plebes. It's a term derived from the Latin plebeian, meaning common citizen.
3rd classmen, the sophomores, are yearlings or yucks.
2nd classmen, the juniors, are affectionately, or maybe ironically, known as cows. And the 3rd classmen, the seniors, are simply firsties.
Okay, the nickname cows is particularly interesting. What's the origin of that?
Well, the most widely accepted theory traces back to the tradition of leave. Cadets historically had no leave whatsoever until the end of their 3rd class, their sophomore year. That's when they were finally granted a long summer furlough.
So their return as 2nd classmen, as juniors, was heralded by the older cadets as the cows coming home, a return to the fold after being out in the pasture of civilian life.
Exactly. It marks their transition from the restricted early years to the greater freedoms of the upper class.
And the organizational structure mirrors the Army. The brigade is broken down into 4 regiments, then battalions, then companies, identified by letter and number A1, B2, H3, and so on.
And all the leadership positions, right down to platoon leader, are held by first-class cadets.
Now, for the plebes, the foundation of their entire existence is a little book called Bugle Notes.
The Plebe Bible. It's this dense, manual-sized collection of every single piece of knowledge a 4th classman is expected to know instantly. Songs, traditions, historical facts about the Academy, the Army, and critically, the rivalry with Navy.
But it's not just fixed information, is it? Plebes have to memorize daily shifting knowledge.
They do. And this includes the running countdown to major Academy events, which they call the day's entire mess hall menu, and perhaps most bizarrely, the lead stories in the New York Times.
Why the New York Times?
The expectation of absolute, immediate, factual recall, even about outside events, is a constant tool used to impose mental pressure and discipline. It forces them to be aware of the world they'll soon be leading in.
This intense pressure cooker environment is softened, or at least ritualized, by traditions that bind them to the long gray line. Let's start with the class ring.
West Point actually started the collegiate tradition of the class ring with the class of 1835. The design is standardized. You have the academy crest on one side, the class crest on the other, but the center stone can be individualized.
And when the senior class receives their rings during ring weekend, there's a charming, if mandatory, interaction with the plebes.
Yes. The freshmen will surround the seniors and ask permission to touch the ring, but only after reciting the required and often goofy poem known as the Ring Poop.
But the ring tradition has a deeper connection to history through the Memorial Class Ring Donor Program, which was established in 2002.
It's a wonderful program. Alumni or their families donate their rings, and that gold is melted and merged, infusing a portion of it into the new Firstie rings.
Just think about the symbolism of that. Every single new ring literally contains atoms of gold from previous classes. Every cadet who graduates is wearing the physical legacy of the long gray line.
Another critical piece of institutional identity is the column number.
It's assigned sequentially to every graduate since the very first, Joseph Gardner Swift, who is column number one, graduating in October 1802.
General George W. Cullum started this chronological numbering system in 1850, not just for identification, but to chronicle the biographies of all graduates. Today, we are pushing past 65,000 alumni identified by a number.
The weight of the column number must be immense.
Oh, it is. When you are standing in a formation and they list graduates by their number, you realize you are merely the latest in a line that stretches back to the post-revolutionary era. You aren't just a soldier. You are column number 64,500.
But not every tradition is about formalized identification in gold. Some lean heavily into pure legend and superstition, which brings us back to the monument we mentioned earlier, Sedgwick's Spurs.
This is truly one of the most delightful aspects of West Point culture. The monument to the Union Civil War General John Sedgwick stands prominently on the plain. And the legend states that if a cadet is dangerously close to failing a critical exam, a term paper, or a final, they have one last resort.
On the night before the final, they have to don their full-dress parade uniform, the official high-collar, buttoned-up gray uniform, and visit the statue at the stroke of midnight.
And then they have to spin the rowels of the statue's bronze spurs.
And then comes the desperate rush. They must run back to the barracks as fast as possible.
Because the legend dictates that if Sedgwick's ghost doesn't catch them, the cadet passes the exam. It's a wonderful example of chaos in a world of order.
It perfectly captures the paradox. An institution defined by ironclad rules and honor secretly tolerates, even celebrates, the tradition of a cadet breaking curfew and sprinting from a ghost, all while wearing the most formal uniform just for the sake of survival.
A tradition tied directly to the intense Navy rivalry is the Goat Engineer Game.
Right, this intramural football game has been played since 1907 as a key lead-up to the official Army-Navy football game. It pits the goats, the bottom half of the senior class academically, against the engineers, the top half.
And the stakes are purely superstitious. Mm. The legend dictates that if the goats win the intramural game, Army beats Navy in the main event.
Given the extreme pressure to perform academically, the goats must relish the chance to succeed where the engineers have failed, even if it's just for bragging rights.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Now, when cadets do break those regulations, like curfew or a minor uniform infraction, they face a distinctive form of punishment known simply as walking the area.
Officially called punishment tours or hours.
Yeah.
This is a highly visible, grueling punishment.
It is. It involves walking back and forth, often for hours on end during their free time, like on weekends in the central area of the barracks courtyard, wearing their full-dress gray uniform and carrying a rifle under arms.
Being late to class might get you 2 hours, but serious infractions can easily accumulate 60 to 80 hours. Cadets who frequently get in trouble are often called area birds.
And the truly unfortunate ones, those who accumulate over 100 total hours in their career, are known as century men. It is a physically and mentally exhausting spectacle designed to use public visibility to reinforce discipline.
Before we discuss the legacy of those who walk the area, we really have to acknowledge the profound social changes that redefined the Corps in the late 20th and early 21st centuries.
The 1970s marked the end of the all-male tradition. Following a congressional amendment to the Defense Authorization Bill, West Point admitted its first 119 women in 1976. They graduated with the class of 1980.
And that integration has permanently changed the face of the academy. Today, women make up about 20% of new entrants. And this inclusion has led to significant diversity in leadership roles, which is a powerful message to the nation.
Absolutely. The first African-American led the Corps of Cadets as first captain in 1979. The first woman held that senior rank in 1989, and more recently, in 2017, Simone Askew became the first African-American woman to hold the rank of first captain, commanding the entire brigade.
And furthermore, after the lifting of the controversial Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in 2011, the Academy began actively admitting and retaining openly gay cadets.
Yes, and that led to the formation of the Spectrum Gay-Straight Alliance Group. By 2015, Spectrum had 40 cadet members and 2 faculty advisors, creating a supportive environment that was just unimaginable decades prior.
The Academy has clearly navigated and adapted to societal changes while fiercely maintaining its core military structure.
It has. Which brings us to the most visible aspect of West Point for many Americans, the famous Army athletics and the true extent of the Long Gray Line legacy.
The athletic pillar is essential to West Point culture, driven directly by MacArthur's belief in the value of competitive strife.
Which is why every cadet, regardless of academic focus, must participate in a sport intercollegiate club or intramural every single semester.
The famous nickname is the Black Knights, shortened from Black Knights of the Hudson, which references the granite buildings and the gray uniforms.
And their mascot is the mule, symbolizing the traditional strength and perseverance required of the Army.
The chief rivalry, of course, is the U.S. Naval Academy. It permeates the daily life of a plebe who has to greet upperclassmen and faculty with the phrase, "Beat Navy."
They even have a physical manifestation of that rivalry. The tunnel running under Washington Road is officially named the Beat Navy Tunnel. They compete against both Navy and the Air Force Academy for the Commander-in-Chief's Trophy, which is a source of intense inter-service pride.
Historically, Army football was absolutely dominant. Under legendary coach Earl Blake in the mid-20th century, they were a national powerhouse.
Oh, completely. They won 3 consecutive national championships from 1944 to 1946, and they produced 3 Heisman Trophy winners, Doc Blanchard, Glenn Davis, and Pete Dawkins.
The Army-Navy game remains a monumental tradition, played as the final regular season Division I college football game, often hosted in a major metropolitan stadium.
And the rivalry is palpable. Navy holds the longest winning streak at 14 consecutive victories, which was finally broken by Army in 2016.
Beyond football, Army maintains a strong presence in the NCAA Division I Patriot League. Their men's lacrosse team is historically strong, with 8 national championships.
And here's a fantastic piece of trivia that shows the broader coaching influence. The legendary NCAA winningest coach, Bob Knight, began his head coaching career at Army.
I did not know that.
And one of his former players and assistants there, a man named Mike Krzyzewski, famously coached Army before moving on to Duke, where he became one of the most successful college basketball coaches of all time. Mm-hmm. The Long Gray Line trains leaders across every field.
And that takes us from the playing fields to the boardrooms and command centers, the true legacy of the Long Gray Line.
The Academy has, surprisingly, gained a recent reputation as a CEO factory.
And this is due to the sheer number of alumni who have achieved major success in the business world, translating that structured, high-stakes military training directly into corporate leadership.
Think about the names. Jim Kimsey, a co-founder of AOL, Alex Gorsky, former CEO of Johnson & Johnson. Bob McDonald, former CEO of Procter & Gamble.
The skills West Point instills structured risk assessment, mission focus, resource allocation, and maintaining composure under intense stress are highly valued at the top tiers of business.
But their military and political legacy remains the most defining. We've already mentioned the Civil War impact, but this lineage includes 2 U.S. presidents, Ulysses S. Grant and Dwight D. Eisenhower, plus Confederate President Jefferson Davis.
In the modern era, the graduates have shaped nearly every major American conflict.
The commanders who oversaw operations in the Middle East and globally, from Norman Schwarzkopf in the Gulf War to David Petraeus, Raymond Odierno, and the current Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, they are all products of the system.
And their influence is truly global. The Long Gray Line has produced 4 foreign heads of state or government.
That's right, including former presidents of Costa Rica, Nicaragua, and the Philippines, and currently the Prime Minister of Cambodia, Hun Manet.
And furthermore, academically, they stand tall against the best civilian institutions. Despite being a service academy, West Point ranks highly among American universities for recipients of prestigious scholarships.
They rank 5th for Rhodes Scholarships, 7th for Marshall Scholarships, and 4th for Hertz Fellowships. This shows they are producing scholars, thinkers, and future innovators, not just warriors.
So if we synthesize all the pieces, the history, the Thayer method, the relentless curriculum, and the global legacy, what do we tell the listener about the nature of West Point today?
What we've unpacked today is the enduring paradox of West Point. It's a highly specialized institution dedicated to creating military leaders, yet it achieves this through a broad, balanced, and uncompromising bachelor science education that's rooted in the engineering principles of the 19th century and the liberal arts of the 21st.
Its centuries-long success really lies in its ability to adapt. integrating women, changing curricula, navigating scandals, while fiercely upholding fundamental traditions like the column number, the honor code, and the rigorous four pillars of development.
And that holistic approach is recognized today. The Academy is consistently ranked in the top 10 in the 2025 edition of Best Colleges and National Liberal Arts Colleges by U.S. News. Its dual identity is not a weakness, it is the source of its strength.
I think the History Department's unofficial motto perfectly encapsulates the scope of its impact on the world. Much of the history we teach was made by people we taught.
It's a powerful realization. You should reflect on how this 223-year-old institution, with its unique blend of academic rigor, physical stress, and strict moral codes, continues to mold leaders who shape domestic and international affairs every single day.
And as a final provocative thought for you to chew on, remember the story of Sedgwick's Spurs. We described a place where honor is absolute, where discipline is enforced by sentry men walking the area, and where failure is not tolerated.
Right.
Yet they maintain a celebrated, shared legend, a secret ritual involving a ghost and a full-dress uniform to grant failing students a sliver of hope and a chance to cope with that impossible pressure.
It suggests that even the most rule-bound institutions understand the human need for tradition, superstition, and a tiny act of defiant hope to overcome impossible odds. So what other seemingly rigid structures in our modern world rely on centuries-old legends or even unofficial superstitions to help their people maintain sanity and perform under duress?
Something to think about the next time you hear those three words: duty, honor, country. We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.